This is attached, 1, 2, 3.
Meeting to order, and would ask council to take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sluka?
Here.
Ammerman?
Here.
Kaiser?
Here.
Senators Nodland?
Here.
Schneider?
Here.
And Wardner?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a quorum. And just for the record, we do have two members participating telephonically.
Very good. Next order of business, we've all received copies of the minutes, and I would entertain a motion to accept the minutes.
I move we accept the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Been moved and seconded that we accept the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay, this morning, we've got four bill drafts to look at this morning, and we do have a letter of comments from Mr. Kenner, who was the injured worker that we had a meeting with, our last meeting with, and he has some additional comments that he would like the committee to entertain, I guess, and you've got copies of those comments. Before we start looking at the bill drafts, we should take a few minutes and just take a look at his comments so that we could kind of keep those in mind as we review the bill drafts. And our committee members that are here telephonically.
Mr. Chairman, I did forward those to Senator Schneider and Representative Kaiser, so if they've got electronic access, they can review those as well.
Okay. Representative Kaiser and Senator Schneider, did you get the copies?
Of the comments?
Of the comments, yes.
Or the bills?
No, the comments. Well, the bills, hopefully you've got those too.
I do have the comments and the bills.
Okay, thank you. We're just going to take a couple of minutes here to kind of review his comments so that we've got those in mind as we review the bill drafts.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for council, if you're ready for it, or we can wait longer.
I think we're ready, Senator Schneider. Go ahead.
Okay. Jennifer, I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph of Luke's letter. He says, however, as you may recall, a similar law already exists, saying that if an employer has not informed his employee about being under a designated medical provider, the employee has the right to choose his own provider. Is that true?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, it is. If you look at the bill draft 199-130199, if you read through the provisions of that existing law, and I'm looking at this to make sure we've got both. I'm wondering if there's a second side to this bill draft. Hang on. It does say that Yeah, I think the one that we emailed you probably has both sides, and this one doesn't. Let me pull up the one I emailed you quickly. But as I read that, I believe it says that if they don't give that notice, they're not required to follow the, to choose from the selected, the designated provider. And I've got Jody Bjornson hesitantly nodding her head here.
Yep, okay. Yeah, and I have the bill draft up now, too.
Okay, do you see that on your bill draft?
Yes, page 2, line 13.
That would be it. I'm going to have to call up and get a second page to these that we've got handed out.
Here it is, the second page.
You copied it?
The second page, yeah.
So, arguably, if Mr. Kenner had pursued his decision, he may have been able to appeal that. I suppose he would have had to have shown that he had made a request and it was denied.
Has everyone had adequate time here to kind of review the comments of Mr. Kenner? If we have, let's proceed then. And as long as we have bill draft 13.0199 up and discussing it,
I'm contacting the office right now to get the second page of that.
I don't have it.
If we can wait, I'll get the.
Okay.
I'll get a new copy for that with the second page.
Okay. All right, we'll leave that one for just a minute here. Let's move on. Let's start looking at these bill drafts. Let's pull up 13.0202 first, which is the bill draft that relates to a committee study. And we would be integrating that study into the independent performance evaluation. And Jen, would you like to just kind of walk through that one?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, which one are you going through? I was just getting that request.
13.0202.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is pretty straightforward. You've seen legislative management studies before. This is a little bit different because the study is being assigned to the committee itself. This is a statutorily created committee. So that varies a little bit. Typically, you see one where it just says legislative management shall study or shall consider studying. This one we're assigning right to this committee because it's statutorily created. Another thing that's unique about this study is that because it's being assigned to this committee, one of the things this committee does every other intern is it selects the elements to be included in WSI's performance evaluation. And we clarify here that one of the ways a study can be performed is to be included as one of those elements in the performance eval. And then when WSI puts up their RFP for the consultant, this will be one of the elements on their charge for that performance eval. And that consultant will then come back to this committee and present the performance eval and include their study and evaluation of the preferred provider program.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ammerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jennifer, is that the one we change from every 2 years to 4 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's right.
So this wouldn't be studied till 4 years down the road?
You did not study it this interim. Or, excuse me, you did not provide for a new performance evaluation during the 11-12 interim. Next interim, during the 13-14, you will. So next interim, in July of 2013, you'll be, or I suppose June of 2013, this committee will be meeting, and one of the things you're going to have to do is select the items that they want included on that performance eval, and this can be one of them. Now I'm looking at WSI. They'll do the performance evaluation that summer, won't they? Or, excuse me, they'll report back like they have historically. They don't have 4 years to do their performance eval.
This is our 2013.
Is that on? Thank you.
Is that better?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they'll issue the RFP, I believe, in 2013, and that's done through the state auditor's office. A firm is selected, and I think they'll commence the performance eval in 2014 and probably report middle of 2014 to this committee.
Mr. Chairman, so committee members, we do the same routine we've done in the past. It's just that WSI then has more time to implement the recommendations from the performance eval before they do another one. I think that was the intent of changing it from 2 to 4 years, is that once the eval is done and the recommendations come out, WSI has additional time to implement those recommendations.
That's correct, Jim.
So we would have a report on this next interim.
Other questions? I think what we'll do with these bill drafts is, as we look at each one of them individually, we'll then try to act on them as to whether or not we want to move them forward. So if we have no other questions, comments, discussion on bill draft 13.0202, I would entertain a motion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt this and move forward.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we move this bill draft 13.0202 forward to be considered by the 2013 Legislative Assembly. All in favor?
Nope, Mr. Chairman, we have to do a roll on that.
Oh, yes. Roll call vote. Thank
Sorry.
You.
So. Representative Ammerman?
Yes.
Kaiser?
Yes.
Senators Nodlin?
Yes.
Schneider?
Yes.
Wardner?
Yes.
And Representative Sukup?
Yes.
The motion is, passes.
Representative Schneider, are you ready to discuss your bill draft, which would be 13.0185?
Sorry, I think I cut out for a second there, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if I heard your last sentence.
Okay. If you're ready to discuss your bill draft 13.0185, why don't we proceed with that one?
Okay, be happy to, Mr. Chairman. To use an overused phrase, Mr. Chairman, this is a very simple bill. Presently, Section 6505-12.2 of the code addresses instances in which there's a medical dispute regarding the percentage of an injured employee's permanent impairment, PPI rating, for shorthand. And in this case, a medical dispute is a pretty basic concept. You know, for example, WSI, through the evaluator that it assigns to do a rating, of an injured worker's permanent impairment, may assign a 15% impairment for the whole person, let's say, for a station and gait disorder, while a doctor affiliated with the injured worker may assign a rating of 30%. Those ratings are obviously irreconcilable, and so there's a medical dispute within the context of this section of the code. And so the process is that all relevant medical evidence, basically the entire claims folder, is then sent to an independent doctor, which is selected from a list provided to the injured worker by WSI. These doctors are kind of informally known in the trade as super docs. And so typically, the super doc truly settles the dispute. And in my limited experience with this section of the code, or they come down somewhere in the middle. And so in the hypothetical case that I just discussed, there's a rating somewhere between 15% and 30%. The super doc comes down, you know, maybe 23 or 17 or 28 or whatever. And under current law, the opinion of the super doc can only be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. And this is a very, very strict standard. And if it's not actually impossible to overcome, it's practically impossible to overcome in this context. And that's the way it should be. You want to settle a dispute about this PPI rating, or else you could litigate it forever. And so the super doc's opinion, it makes sense to have that essentially carry controlling weight. However, in a case that I handled last year, there was an injured worker who had essentially two separate impairments that comprised his total PPI rating. One rating went through the medical dispute process like it typically does. A WSI's worker, or WSI's doctor, rated the injured worker a little lower than the doctor that he was affiliated with. The super doc comes in somewhat in the middle, I think even closer to the injured worker's rating, and the dispute is settled. However, the second impairment was a completely different story. Again, you have a dispute between WSI's assigned rating and the rating that the injured worker's doctor believes the injured worker is entitled to. In this case, the super doc concluded that my client had a 0% rating for the whole person. And so neither WSI's evaluator nor the evaluator affiliated with the injured worker said anything about him not suffering a degree of permanent impairment for that particular condition. But because the way the law is written, the super doc's opinion is essentially controlling, because it can only be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. And I think I mentioned at the last committee meeting, I'm not sure I could prove the theory of gravity by clear and convincing evidence. It's just very difficult to overcome. And so the changes proposed in this bill draft would essentially say, if the dispute, or if the rating by the super doc is somewhere in between the two existing ratings, it's entitled to that presumption that it can only be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. But if it's lower than the lowest or higher than the highest, it'll be discarded in favor of either the lowest opinion if it's low, or the highest opinion if it's high. And so I believe the changes truly bring, or are truly reflective of the intent of this section of the code, and that's to settle a dispute. It's not to essentially reevaluate and provide a third opinion that conflicts with the other two. Any questions about that?
Mr. Chairman, this is George. Could I ask a question of both Jennifer and Mac on this?
Yes, go ahead.
My question is, I understand your argument very well, but what would we do in a situation where both the claimant's physician and WSI's physician make a rating, and then the independent comes in and goes outside of that threshold, but provides information, you know, let's say clear and convincing arguments of something that neither of the other doctors recognized in their rating process, but now that it had been pointed out, they would say, oh, well, yeah, we didn't think about that, or we didn't see that in the MRI or whatever, and he is right, or she. So could we put clear and convincing, if we switch to the independent outside of the rating, that would only be upheld with clear and convincing evidence or something to that effect?
Mr. Chairman, and Jennifer can correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Kaiser, but the in the case where an opinion comes in lower than the lowest, you could still rebut the existing opinion through clear and convincing evidence, arguing that the super doc caught something that the other two doctors didn't, and if he proved that the super doc's rating was more accurate through clear and convincing evidence, then that opinion would control. But it would essentially shift the burden to demonstrating that the existing opinions are not established through clear and convincing evidence. So it shifts the burden, essentially. And I'm sure Jennifer can explain that more artfully than I just did.
But, yeah, and that's, I guess, my argument, is that with your new language, I think it may take away that possibility. I'm not sure. And that's why I'm not an attorney, by the way.
Yeah.
Wait, Jennifer, isn't that what this says right here? That last sentence?
The last sentence?
Last sentence under B.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe WSI could also comment. I suspect they have some of their legal staff there as well.
Let me try to just rephrase it, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kaiser. Presumptive evidence, this is from page 2, line 3 and 4. Presumptive evidence under this subsection may be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. And so the presumptive evidence in this case, where a super doc's opinion comes in lower than the lowest or higher than the highest, the presumptive evidence would be the highest of the highest or the lowest of the lowest opinions. However, you could rebut that opinion by clear and convincing evidence. And so if the super doc's opinion was clear and convincing, then you've rebutted the existing evaluations.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kaiser, committee members, I think I lean towards Senator Schneider's reading of that what we're doing is creating a presumption here, and the presumption would be the highest or the lowest in that situation. But it is rebuttable, and one of the ways you could rebut it would be by looking at that newly considered evidence, or that, you know, if it's convincing, clear and convincing, then you can make it higher or lower than those two initials.
So you can go outside of the two initial ratings and have it upheld?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kaiser, that's my initial reading, is if you can rebut that by clear and convincing. So if that super doc's newly considered evidence or that new approach was clear and convincing, then yes, it could be.
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, maybe a practical example of how this law would work would help illustrate this for the committee. So let's say that the changes proposed in this bill were in place when my client was going through this process. Rather than my client having to rebut the super doc's opinion through clear and convincing evidence, WSI would have to establish through clear and convincing evidence that opinion controlled, since it was lower than the lowest. That's probably the easiest way to think about this. Yeah.
Tim or Jody, either one of you care to comment?
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Tim Walling with WSI. I think that that's an accurate reading of the way it's drafted here. Yeah, I do. I believe that super doc opinion, if it is outside the corridor of those two opinions that have already come in, could be supported in the event you could show that it was strong enough to rebut that initial presumption, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kaiser.
No, if it does what was described, Mr. Chairman, I'm more than happy with the language.
Okay, very good. Any other questions, comments, Senator Wardner?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure. So when we're saying that if the super doc comes in above the medical doctor's presumption, let's say the medical doctor said it was a 28 and super doc came in at 31, then if what the super doc provided couldn't be rebutted, we go to 31 instead of 28. Is that correct? Is that what we're saying here? That we could use that number for permanent partial, you know, percent of impairment? That's what I'm understanding. Am I understanding it correct?
Well, Senator Schneider, do you want to respond to that question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Wardner, this is a two-edged sword. So the injured worker, you know, if the super doc came in with an opinion that was higher than the opinion of his treating doctor, he wouldn't see a windfall from that. He would then have to establish, he would have to rebut the opinion of his own treating doctor or own hired evaluator through clear and convincing evidence to establish that he was entitled to a higher impairment rating. So it really is, it puts the injured worker and WSI in the same boat. They have to live with the opinions that they've proffered and put into evidence.
And then, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, then if it's the other way around and they come in lower than, let's say, WSI had said it, then the WSI would be happy probably with that, but the injured worker would have to prove that with clear and convincing evidence that it needed to be moved up.
That's the way I understand it. Correct? Senator Schneider?
I don't know if I'm interrupting anybody, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. But I think the best way to think about this is it kind of sets a floor and a ceiling. And the ceiling would be the opinion that's most favorable to the injured worker. The floor would be the opinion that's most favorable to WSI / least less favorable to the injured worker.
Other questions? Discussion, comments? What are your wishes, committee, with this draft bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I move to accept this draft bill and move it forward as presented.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, the motion's been made and seconded that we move draft bill 13.0185 forward to be considered by the 2013 legislature. Jen, would you take a roll call vote?
Representatives Ammerman?
Yes.
Kaiser?
Yes.
Senators Nodland?
Yes.
Schneider?
Yes.
Wardner?
No.
And Representative Sukas?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Okay, let's look at are we ready to look at
199? We are.
Okay.
Sorry for that.
Okay. Okay, let's look at 13.0199 next, and that's we'll let Jen walk through this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. One of the what I think helpful things about this bill is that it essentially has the law creating the preferred provider program all in one bill. So you can see the parameters of this program right here. And we've done a little bit of housekeeping, so what you see on page one is housekeeping. Who to that, prior to before. The additions we've made are on page 2, lines 13 through 26. And I think Senator Schneider already pointed out that there already is a requirement here that an employer notify their employee of the program. If they don't notify them of the program, that employee is not required to follow that provider. They don't have the consequences of not going within network if they haven't so been notified. Obviously, there's going to be an obligation on the part of the employee if they go outside a network and the employer claims they need to be in network. There are going to be some issues that need to be determined here. But the law is there. The foundation's already there. One of the things that I think we've probably strengthened a little bit is that once you have, as an employer, decided to use this program, you have to give your employees initial notice of that decision. You've got to post it. And then anytime you hire a new employee, you've got to also notify them as they come on board. We've got this program. We've added into that that, and every year, at least every year thereafter, it could be with your tax forms. You know, put a flyer in there reminding your employee, remember, we've got this program, and here's our identified provider, and here are the terms of this program. When I say the terms of it, they're on this sheet. And WSI gave you a brochure at the last meeting about the program. You know, just let them know that if you don't go to this, you know, you've got a right to opt out. If you don't go to our in-network provider, WSI is not going to pay for it. You know, those are the terms of it. Once you're injured, if you want to opt out, you've got to wait 30 days before you request it, and then it's going to be another 30 days before we'll cover. So there's some rules you need to play by within this program. So that's what we're talking, you know, that's what I anticipate is going to be passed on when we talk about the terms of the preferred provider program. You'll notice on that subsection 5, we're also making sure that they tell the employees about the terms of the program. Don't just tell them you need to go to Sanford. Tell them that you can opt out before an injury. Once you're injured, you can opt out, but here's how you need to do it. You can't just get injured and say, I'm not going to Sanford, I'm going to St. A's. You've got to wait 30 days to request it, and then you're going to wait at least another 30 days before you can go to whoever your doctor is. So I think Mr. Kenner's, you saw his comments on this. We don't really know how this would have played out with Mr. Kenner because I don't know that he pursued it. I think he felt like he was in touch with his claims analyst, but it doesn't sound as if a claim analyst ever thought he said, I'm opting out of this. So that's what this bill draft is intended to do, to address.
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Wardner.
The most important thing, though, here is there's a due process here where that employee needs to know what the rules are. And am I correct? That's what this does. It says, here are the rules, and they need to know about it, and the employer needs to make sure they know. Is there teeth in it to make sure that they, I mean, I don't know if we, I don't know if I'm, I mean, he talks about that they should have to pay a fine for not, and to be honest with you, all the calls I get and stuff, I'm starting to feel that way too. The employer needs to let their employees know what the rules are. That's
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wardner, you know, the teeth are on lines 25 and 26 of that second page, and I guess it's up to you whether you think that's adequate or not. You know, and that's, the teeth are only as valid as it is as the employee knows they have the right to get out. You know, if you're in a situation where that employee hasn't been told the terms, then how would they know that they have that this section doesn't apply to them? You know, that's kind of the circular argument here, is if you didn't learn the terms of your preferred provider program, how would you know that if they didn't tell me, I didn't have to use it?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative, or Senator Nadler.
Well, Mike, again, I have to look at Luke's, when he goes down and talks about, you know, what is the fine or what is the incentive for the employer to do that? I mean, what does the worker do if the employer doesn't? I mean, we're saying that they have to, but what are we saying, what happens if they don't? And I think that's the biggest issue that Senator Wardner's bringing up is, most of these players said, well, so what? We don't care. You know, do we want to do what Luke is asking us, is do we want to show some kind of an incentive for the employer to do it? Not just a law that says he does it. What if he doesn't do it? How do we protect the worker? because I know very well Luke's case. He's been sharing that with me from day one, and, you know, he's a pretty astute young man. But he was really bombarded and really felt, you know, just like he was shoved around and no answers and no one was helping him with his situation. And he probably enhanced his situation with the things he did that to his disadvantage. But I think he's got a good point here. What good is the law if there isn't any meat in it? If we just say this is the law, what's the incentive to make sure you follow the law? That's my question. Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Representative Ammerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if Tim or somebody has the answer, like, is there something already in place? Say there are an employer, maybe a couple of them that do this and really don't care, you know, what's the penalty? Is there anything in statute now, or like raising their rates or whatever if they, you know, don't follow this or something along that line? How it would work?
Tim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Tim Walling. To address the first question, when I read the statute, the enforcement portion of it is an employer who selects a DMP and does not notify their employees, their DMP selection is not effective. That employee can go wherever they want, and we'll honor that because that was not given, notice was not given.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize, but I am having a lot of trouble hearing both of the last speakers. Is it possible for them to pull their mics a little closer?
We'll do that, see if it helps.
This is Tim Walling with Workforce Safety and Insurance. Is that better?
Is that better, George?
Yes.
With respect to Representative Ammerman's question, my answer was, what is the effectiveness should an employer not notify an employee of their designated medical provider selection? That selection becomes ineffective, meaning that the employee can select whatever provider they want to and attend that employee or attend that provider. So the enforcement portion of the statute, that's what I read it to be, meaning that what this employer has attempted to do will not be honored. The second portion that I apologize because last hearing this drifted into an area I hadn't really anticipated. One of the questions that came up, and I know that was again asked by Senator Wardner today, is what notification is there out there? This time I did more homework and anticipated. There are a couple of different things I'd like to hand out to the committee that are currently in existence for your review. One of them is the poster that's required to be posted, and you will notice on that. On that required posting by an employer, at subsection 2 here, it explains what a DMP is, how an employee is able to opt out, and how that takes place. So this is required every year to be posted at all employers within the state. And so that is a type of notification, I think, and I wanted to just address to you because I believe we left you with the impression that there was nothing. Additionally, we pulled off our actual documents that are on our website. It's a two-page document. The first page is for an employer to select a designated medical provider. The second page is for amendments and for employee selection. And so these are the documents that are out there. To the extent that they're effective in providing notice to our injured workers and our employees, we certainly would hope that they're effective. But to the extent that I left you with the impression that there's nothing, I apologize, and I wanted to clear that up for you and hopefully answer Senator Wardner's question with that information.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nodland.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Tim,
Other than periodic inspections, you know, I forget how many new employers we have in the state with the oil industry. You know, how do we know that these are posted? I mean, you know, I'm kind of pushing the point a little bit, but I think that's Mr. Kenner's issue here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nodland, ultimately, other than requiring that they be posted, we don't know. There are times if we find out information from an employee that, in fact, that's not been posted, they have not been given information on the designated medical provider selection, the adjuster will go back, they're in contact with the provider, or, excuse me, the employer, and would follow up with that, I would hope. And that would also give insight to the payment of the medical bills. If there has been a selection on our in our system, but there's been no information given, obviously we're not going to be honoring that designated medical provider selection.
Mr. Chairman. So what you're saying, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what you're saying is once there's a claim, these kind of questions are asked and investigated as to if they've been notified and been told all the rules and regulations. That would be one of the first things that would be in the interview.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nodland, obviously it may not be part of the first interview, but if there is a disagreement that arises, I was never told that, that's when it would be triggered to be looked into.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Tim, just a question here, I guess. If we were to put, you know, some kind of a fine or a penalty for the employer not following through properly here with informing his employees, what kind of a problem would that present, you know, to WSI? You know, you'd have to be able to prove somehow that he didn't follow through. What would we be looking at, you know, as far as how this would affect WSI?
Mr. Chairman, it would certainly fairly significantly change WSI's role with respect to relationships with injured workers and employers. And what I say by that is we are an insurer. We develop rates. We develop safety programs. We are not necessarily a regulatory agency where we are going out investigating and finding employers or finding injured workers. So to that extent, it takes us out of something that we do day to day. I can't think of anywhere that WSI does any enforcement or fining, either injured workers and become that policing entity.
Yeah. I see that as a hang up and a problem trying to enforce something like that. But any other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a comment for the committee to consider. As I read through this, the one area, it's great to inform your employees at the time of hire that you have this plan, but in all honesty, it's going to be provided with a lot of other information about your organization and a lot of paperwork is being filled out. And I'm not certain that my employees would really understand the important significance of or significance of this event. What we have never addressed is, and in our company, we enforce it as much as we can through our safety program. The minute somebody is injured, they are to report it immediately, and we report it so that we can circumvent paying the deductible and report it within 24 hours. Now, obviously, if it's a big emergency and we have to call an ambulance and they're unconscious, there's nothing in those situations, obviously, that could be done. But in the average injury in our company, the person reports the injury and we start paperwork. It just seems to me at that time, when reasonable, the employer should again inform the employee that we are part of this program and this is the situation, because then it is really relevant. If they come in and say, gee, I hurt my back yesterday, and we say, well, you, and no one says to them, well, you have to go to this provider, and they go out and go to a provider and file their claim in the meantime, all we're going to do is create a lot of hassles. And it seems to me we ought to ask employers, when possible, to inform the injured worker at the time of the injury report being reported.
So are you,
Senator Schneider?
When I was an adjunct faculty member of the UND Law School last summer, I was presented with a written document that asked me whether or not I wanted to select my own doctor in the event of a work-related injury. That's probably some pioneering HR professional at the University of North Dakota that put that sheet in front of me. But it certainly was helpful, and I think most employees, when presented with the choice of whether to be sent to a doctor or choose their own, at least to some extent, they're going to choose their own. I understand we're under the gun here, and we have a bill draft in front of us, but I think a lot of these problems could be short-circuited if the employer merely just presented the employee written notice on which they would indicate whether or not the employee wants to essentially receive care under the preferred provider program in the event of a work-related injury.
Other discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see this move forward, and then during the session that they look at it some more, but I think it's reasonable here. What we're trying to do is keep costs down. That's why they go to the preferred provider. And so I'll move the adoption to move this piece of legislation forward. Recommend it.
Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second. Was that you, Senator Schneider?
No, it was George.
Okay. So we have a motion on the floor that's been made and seconded to move bill draft number 13.0199 forward to be considered again by the 2013 Legislative Assembly. Jen, would you take the roll?
Thank you. Representatives Ammerman?
Yes.
Kaiser?
Yes.
Senators Nodland?
Yes.
Schneider?
Yes.
Wardner?
Yes.
Representative Tukin?
Yes.
The motion is successful.
All right, the last bill draft that we have before us will be bill draft 13.0203. Pretty direct. Jen, if you want to just run through that quickly.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, from this bill draft, we're creating a new section to the chapter of law that generally pertains to WSI as the organization. You can see that we're approaching this from the perspective of if WSI is going to enter a professional relationship with a medical provider, that's the triggering event. If they enter that relationship with a medical provider, now that medical provider should have a duty to inform their patients who are injured workers that they also wear that hat as a consultant. It's kind of that transparency discussion of make sure your patients know that you've got a relationship with WSI so they're not blindsided by it later. I think in Mr. Kenner's case, he saw two medical providers who had consulting relationships with WSI. The first one he saw, that medical, if you were to look through his medical records that we saw, that physician documented very carefully that he told that injured worker, please know that this is a consulting relationship I have with you, I'm not your treating doctor, because that was the case. And know that I do have a contractual relationship with WSI. I'm not I'm not working for them right now, but just so you know, I've got a relationship with WSI. So that seems to be an example of how this could work well. In another instance, he went to see a chiropractor, and I don't think the medical, obviously I haven't read all the medical records, from, but what we are presented, it doesn't appear as though that chiropractor ever notified him that he also has a consulting relationship with WSI. He wasn't consulting with WSI on Mr. Kenner's case, so there wasn't that professional conflict of interest. Just that I think Mr. Kenner testified that he wasn't pleased to find out that that doctor was wearing two hats in his professional life. So that's what this is trying to address.
Discussion. Representative Ammerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jennifer, the professional relationship, I don't know if I need that explained a little bit better, but would that be something like, say, that chiropractor, is that somebody maybe that WSI had used as an independent medical doctor at one time, or what? I'm struggling because the professional relationship, I know it seems kind of broad, I'm not sure. Seems like just about anybody in the state I'm going to have with some kind of professional relationship as far as that goes. Can you help me out with that?
And you may be hitting on a point. I may have used too broad of a stroke here. However, my intent in drafting was it. I want a broad stroke here because I don't know all the different ways WSI contracts for providers to provide a service to them, specifically to them. I don't know all the times they do that. I know they do IMEs, so that's I would assume that would qualify under this. I know they do claim reviews. I'm not sure if they, when they work those cases, if they bring in a specialist who may know about that particular element of an injured case. I guess I'd look to WSI to say, is this perceived as being too broad?
Tim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think Representative Ammerman has presented an issue that certainly I thought about when I glanced through the draft, but I'm fairly certain that there are an awful lot of medical providers within the state who have provided us information at our request who would probably come under here who wouldn't even know. Because we consult for utilization review services, we consult for appropriateness reviews with respect to all of our different types of apparatus that were prescribed. We'll oftentimes go out and see if that's medically appropriate with somebody else. When those relationships end, are they still considered? Do some of them ever end? It raises issues with respect to defining those relationships, and I'm pretty sure that my view differs from what those different consulting positions, physical therapists, chiropractors, probably would view their relationship with us is as well. When we ask a second opinion, we're contacting them and seeking input. Does that qualify, and will that require additional information to be given? I don't know.
Does a doctor know when he's examining a patient that it's a, before he examines the patient, does he always know that it's a WSI injured worker?
Mr. Chairman, prior to the actual meeting with the person, I doubt it. As that meeting goes forward, one of the requirements generally is that they're going to find out what the mechanism of the accident or injury is. That will trigger a number of different things in the system. So after the meeting, they should know that it's a WSI patient, yes. There's different requirements. They must provide us medical notes through the institution. Blue Cross and Blue Shield doesn't require that. So they should find out at some point during that relationship.
Yeah, I was just wondering if, you know, if this were to become law, if a doctor, in order to be safe, would just have to stay up front. You know, I have a working relationship with WSI, and you know, state that to every patient, just to be on the safe side. Other questions? Discussion. Okay, committee, what would be your wishes then with this bill draft?
motion to adopt the bill draft. Bring it forward, move it forward, hopefully during the session, as is brought up, if it needs amendments or needs more discussion, you know, the committee that will receive it can, I don't know, tighten it up in there or whatever the term might be, but I think it's a good bill draft and might need some work, so I'd like to move forward so we can continue this on during the session.
I'll second it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, motion's been made and seconded that we move Bill Draft 13.0203 forward for consideration by the 2013 Legislative Assembly, and I'll ask council to take the roll.
Thank you. Representatives Ammerman?
Yes.
Kaiser?
No.
Senators Nodland?
Yes.
Schneider?
Yes.
Wardner?
Yes.
Representative Sukup?
No.
The motion does pass.
Okay, that takes care of the four bill drafts that are before us. I think.
Mr. Chairman, this Representative Kaiser, I'm going to have to sign off at this point.
All right, Representative Kaiser, thank you for being with us, and thank you for your comments, and I think we're getting close to being done, so we'll see you next time.
All right, thanks so much, everybody.
Next item on the agenda is a presentation by Jody Bjornson regarding the workforce safety and insurance proposed legislative packages.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Jody Bjornson, General Counsel at WSI. And I'm going to, at a high level, take you through some of the concepts that we're considering for our legislative agenda this year internally. I was told yesterday that I tend to get a little windy when making this presentation, so I will try to keep it at a high level and succinct. But if you do have questions and want to talk about any of these concepts in more detail later on, we're sure happy to do that. So essentially, we have two bills. We have one main bill that covers the claimant side of things, the injured worker side of things, and then another bill that covers the insurance side of things, the employer services side. And I'll run through the claimant bill first. What we're doing, what we'd like to do in our claimant bill, first off, is to remedy an inequity that exists with our state guard members, and this particular provision stem from an actual claim. We have a federal employee, maybe the Army National Guard on the state side, and are in the federal system on the federal side. Well, we have state active duty, which a number of folks were in state active duty with the floods in Minot, and that person then becomes under the North Dakota workers' comp system. The state has coverage for those individuals. We had an individual that was injured as a guard member on the job, received disability benefits, and then his active duty ended. When he switched back to his federal employment, his disability benefits were no longer available to him because the feds have their own system, their own workers' comp system, and we were unable to pay that individual any further disability benefits, even though he continued to be disabled from that state injury as a guard member. So what we're proposing to do is to change our definition of wages so that we may consider the federal wages that that individual receives along with the state wages in the event that this comes up for any guard member in the future. Kind of a quagmire that extends from being a federal employee, switching to a state employee, and then back to a federal employee. We're going to see it. It's a minimal occurrence. It's a minimal occurrence, but it did exist. It came to our attention. We are working with I guess the guard approached us to look at this issue, and we've worked with them on some concepts as to how to remedy it. The next thing we'd like to do is be able to consider some post-injury wages, and a number of these initiatives are going to stem from our changing demographics in North Dakota. Or what we're seeing is an in-migration of folks to come and work. Once an individual is injured, they may leave the state and go back to from where they came. And so as a result of that, we have a situation and probably best described by example. We have an individual injured in North Dakota. They are entitled to disability benefits. They then leave the state and may become engaged in another employment, say their own self-independent employment. They may do Tupperware or sell Mary Kay, something like that. Well, once they're out of the bounds of North Dakota coverage, we're arguably precluded from considering those post-injury wages that they may be making out of state. What we'd like to consider and what we're talking about is being able to take those wages that that individual is earning and be able to consider that with their entitlement to disability benefits or with the vocational perspective. You're out there working. You have a pocket of wages. Obviously, that's demonstrative that you can do something. So that's the basic concept of that bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wardner.
Mr. Chairman and Jody, so what's happening now, they go out of state, they continue to get the disability, and plus then they go back to work at something, and so they're kind of double dipping, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wardner, that's exactly right. You said it more artfully than I did, but that's exactly the concept, double dipping. The next main concept that we have also stems from we're seeing more out-of-state employees, and it stems from our ability when we have a work injury in North Dakota, injured worker files in North Dakota, we begin paying benefits, and then subsequently they may file in another jurisdiction. They may be eligible for benefits in more than one state. Once they file for benefits in another jurisdiction, WSI stops paying. We suspend benefits, and we ask once they get benefits in that other state and they commence payment for every benefit that we've paid out to get back. We want that money back. You filed in another state, we've paid you, you pay us back. You've chosen another jurisdiction. Well, we're having a hard time recovering those dollars. Right now, our option is to really go and ask the injured worker to repay those benefits either through our administrative system or alternatively through a collection action in the civil realm. What we're proposing to do is to add, I guess, some more ability to recover those payments by adding the insurance company of the employer, the employer, the injured worker's attorney. I think that's about it. And in other words, if you get benefits from that other state and we're not notified and paid back within a certain time frame, 60 days, then we have the ability to bring a suit against one or all of those characters or players that I mentioned. Okay, and what we did was lifted that provision from another provision in the law in our subrogation statutes, and it basically mirrors how we handle those claims when we don't get our money back. The intent is just to make it a little easier for us to recover the dollars that we've spent and avoid double dipping, I guess, of the injured worker. We are seeing more of this. We are, with the nomadic nature of the employees, we are seeing this to be a rising issue, and we're not getting recovery.
Representative Ammerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jody, if I was injured in this state, you know, say for 3 months and you were paying my medical bills and wages and so on, and I got, after 3 months, say I could filed for another state, Wyoming or someplace, and I did that. You know, will Wyoming come back and pay the first 3 months? Or are they going to start when I file there? Or are you, you understand what I'm trying to get at?
I do. It may be that, I think the point of your question is, do they pick up where WSI left off and move forward? Mr. Chairman and Representative Ammonman, they do not. When they become eligible for benefits in that jurisdiction, they treat it like any other claim and pay the benefits from the beginning that they're entitled to. Now, is that always clear? No, because a lot of benefits have been paid already by North Dakota, so it gets to be complicated in sorting out what has been paid and what the other jurisdiction is picking up. I understand that. It's not clear. But generally, they start from day one when that claim is filed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nadler.
And Mr. Chairman, Jody, when you talk about other states, it's kind of unique to us now because of the nomadic workers with the oil industry. Are there any kind of communication or agreements or anything between states? I mean, this is just new. It's new to North Dakota, but this has been going on in many other states in that type of an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a better way of notification between the states, or am I just...
No, Mr. Chairman and Senator Nodland, I wish there were. Unless, I guess, every state in workers' comp is so unique and so different, there is not a coordinated effort of which I'm aware to preclude this type of situation. The only thing I can think of is our reciprocity agreement that we have in place that allow for somebody's injured, a North Dakota employee's injured in Wyoming, they will file that claim back in North Dakota and vice versa. That would eliminate this issue to some extent, but statewide, no.
So is that something that we should pursue?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nodland, I think that's a very noble endeavor, but I would consider it to be fairly overwhelming. I don't know how we could get all those players to the table statewide and agree on some sort of procedure that could remedy this. But in concept, it would be wonderful.
Thank you.
Jody, how do you find out that an injured worker is getting compensation from another jurisdiction?
Mr. Chairman, a number of ways. The situations in which I've been involved, sometimes they tell us. Sometimes we find out in a reference in a medical record. Injured workers filed with Minnesota, for example, and triggers us to then communicate with that injured worker. Sometimes the employer may tell us. There's really no set way that comes into us. Luck of the draw.
So there's some of that probably that goes unnoticed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Senator Wardner?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Jody, I guess I'm puzzled that if a worker is injured in a state, that's where they would get their benefits. I would guess that what the company has a presence in Wyoming, using Wyoming as an example, and North Dakota, so therefore the employee has the ability to go to either state and file.
Mr. Chairman and yes. Senator Wardner, that's right. Jurisdiction generally is driven by, pardon me, resident of the employee, location of the employee's business, where the employer does business, all those facts. And so it isn't uncommon for an individual to qualify for benefits in more than one state, typically North Dakota, Minnesota, the surrounding states, yes. We have a whole chapter on jurisdiction, and it can become very complicated in nature. But overall, it's where that employee lives and works, where the employer is, and where that employer does business are the factors that we would analyze and consider. Yes.
Oh, one more thing. Mr. Chairman and Jody, I guess I'm surprised that if the injury was, took place in North Dakota, that Wyoming would even want to consider it in there. I mean, that puzzles me. I mean, you'd think they'd say, that happened in their state, they need to take care of it. You are an insurance company, you want to keep claims down, and vice versa. Why would you, or why would our WSI want to pick up somebody who was, you know, they may be from North Dakota, but they got injured in Wyoming, you know, so I don't know.
Sure, right, and we basically, I understand your frustration, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wardner. The only thing that WSI can do is, I guess, implement and consider the jurisdictional law. We don't really have a choice if the law provides that we need to pick up that case, but in many events it can be frustrating, you bet.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nodley.
Just a little follow-up on that. So if somebody is injured to the total ability, you know, where they have a lifelong disability in North Dakota, but they're originally from Texas, and then worked with a company that is in both North Dakota and Texas, so, but they move back home to Texas, we will continue to pay their disability. If it's a permanent disability.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nodland, we will continue to pay that disability for as long as that person's disabled.
Right.
The fact that they move doesn't matter. It doesn't stop their stream of benefits. Mm-hmm.
But if I may follow up, but then if they go and claim in Texas, try to file a claim, we have nothing to do with that. We can't. Only thing Texas has to verify with North Dakota, I would think.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nodland, we can't stop that filing in Texas if they file. Hopefully we would find out about it and suspend benefits, but if they qualify for Texas, there's nothing that's stopping them from filing there if they meet the timeline in which to file a claim in Texas. You bet. Communication's an issue. Mm-hmm. Anything else there?
Other questions, other discussion?
All right, moving right along. The next issue that we're encountering that led to some discussion on proposed legislation surrounds incarceration. Right now, if an individual is incarcerated beyond 72 hours in the North Dakota correctional system, their disability benefits are suspended. They stop. The medical portion continues. We'll pay the medical portion, but that disability, that wage replacement benefit stops. What we're running into are some issues when somebody is incarcerated long-term. For instance, we have somebody that's entitled to disability benefits. They're incarcerated for 5 or 6 years. We suspend during that time. But then the law provides that when they are released from incarceration, that we pick them up again. We reinstate benefits. What we're proposing is to tier the disability benefits and incarceration. So if you are incarcerated for 72 hours, between 72 hours and 30 days, then we will suspend your benefits between 30 days and more, we're going to discontinue your benefits and you have to reapply for benefits. Just like anybody else that has gone off our system for reasons unrelated to the work injury and wants to come back on, you have to reapply formally. We don't just automatically instate. One, it's consistent with how we handle other injured workers that, I guess, whose benefits cease because of their own choices and conduct. And two, sometimes it gets really difficult to medically manage that claim if you haven't been in touch with that person for 5 years. And to find their status out, I guess it's a bit of a shift to have them prove that they're still entitled rather than us pay the money without any answers to questions. So that's what we're looking at, to hopefully make that a little bit more succinct, and I guess appropriate, for lack of a better word. Can I answer any questions about that? The next provision, remember we contracted with that entity called Corval to do our vocational rehabilitation services for WSI. And one of our larger provisions is just cleanup language related to bringing that voc rehab service in-house. We're now making it consistent with what our practice is, and that is to have those voc rehab specialists as WSI employees. So you'll likely see a provision in that regard. It looks a lot worse than it really is. It just takes a lot of pages. The other thing that we're looking at in our voc rehab process is to streamline basically the consequences for not engaging in a good faith work search for voc rehab. And also, basically there's choices within our voc rehab system that if you are in non-compliance, there's a provision that's broad and that allows the organization to suspend benefits. There's also another provision that's more specific and talks about you get two times to be in non-compliance with voc rehab without good cause, and after that your benefits are terminated. So we have a general provision that could be employed and a more specific provision that could be employed. It's not fair to have a choice there. We want to treat everybody the same. We're choosing to eliminate the broad perspective and just go with that choice that is more specific. Our adjusters are running into trouble. Oh, I can pick one or I can pick the other. Well, that doesn't really ultimately result in fairness to every injured worker when they have a choice. So that's another one of our provisions. Let me see. A few provisions are cleanup. We're just synthesizing and putting language that's in two provisions into one provision. That has to deal with our content of the biannual report. And from an injured worker side, I think I've covered most of the major provisions, if not all. Yeah. On the employer side, you heard Tim talk a little bit about WSI is hoping to be more of the partner with the employer. We're there to help them. We're there to provide safety consultants and measures to hopefully eliminate workforce injury. And historically, we haven't been the hammer. We've tried to be the carrot and I guess serve a role as working with the employers and injured workers. However, we do have enforcement power in our law that allows us to enforce penalties when safety violations are violated. And I guess our concern is to conform that section to our current philosophy and practice. What we'd like to do is, there's a term in the law that reads, we shall issue and enforce proper safety and safety regulations. We'd like to put in the law that be may. If we feel necessary, that if it's necessary in a situation to have to enforce, we still have the power to do it, but not every situation calls for an enforcement mechanism. You know, we have other entities to do that. We have OSHA that better serves that role. So that's our first initiative. The other thing that we're seeing that is a result of the oil boom, so to speak, has to do with the payment of premiums. And what we'd like to propose is to allow WSI to require prepayment of premiums. You pay us before you're considered insured. Make that process available to us to require the repayment of premiums when we see that it's reasonable and necessary. Right now we have to give notice. A certain number of days have to pass. But we may have employers in the state that come in for a short period of time, we don't get our money, and they're gone, and it's difficult to collect. So when we see a red flag, if our premium folks think it's necessary to preserve the fund's interest, to require that prepayment, we have the ability to do so. Corresponding to that is to beef up our penalties for noncompliance and the failure to secure premiums. Right now, the longer you're in noncompliance, the higher the percentage of the penalty you will incur. Okay, it's on a scale, a graduated scale. What we're asking for is for each passing year that entity does not have coverage and should have, that we can impose a $2,000 penalty per year for not securing securing coverage when they should have. Basically, the perspective is with these multi-million, billion-dollar companies, they come in, our current penalty structure is weak and really isn't a deterrent factor to maintain coverage, or to obtain coverage, rather. And so we'd like to have the ability to impose more difficult or more stringent sanctions, I think, that would result in a deterrent factor. So that was the discussion that we've had surrounding those issues.
Senator Nodland.
Mr. Chairman, Jody, how are you notified of companies coming into the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nodland, I'm going to defer to Barry, if you wouldn't mind. I think he can tell you firsthand more accurately than I could.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nodland, we are the exclusive provider of workers' compensation in the state of North Dakota. Upon entry into the state, the vast majority of policyholders will notify us. They do understand the rules and regulations coming into the state. Unfortunately, there is a good number of employers, typically the smaller employers, that are unfamiliar with the monopolistic environment. And it is not until sometimes a claim takes place. The claim, there's an accident, there's an injury, the claimant goes to the hospital, there's the claim that's filed with the organization. It's only until that point or until that instant that we become aware that we have an employer in the state that is uninsured. And so looking at that, we want to give some or add some additional teeth to our noncompliant penalties. As Jody indicated, 25% the first year sometimes is not sufficient. We'd like to be able to assess that additional $2,000 penalty. But to your question directly, typically the vast majority of employers do comply voluntarily. There are those 5-10%. It's not until a claim takes place. We do have safety consultants. We do have premium auditors in the field. They do also do searches. They recognize an out-of-state contractor. They will go into our system, take a look, see if there is a policy issued for that individual business, and if not, they will follow up with an underwriter, and then we will contact that business. So that's another means by which we identify these policyholders.
Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Well, you know, visiting the Secretary of State, that's one of the things that he has also, is that they have to register with the Secretary. I just assume, as a private citizen, assuming that information was shared between state agencies to be able to keep up on this, because it's overwhelming. I mean, I don't know how many thousand, you know the number better than I do, but it's in the thousands of new businesses, and so many of them are the new people that are actually North Dakota people that start up a business, and if they don't get good advice from an accountant or an attorney that works for them, you know, how do they know? And I'm sure that's the big problem.
Senator Nodland, members of the committee, you hit on an excellent point. We do have a great relationship with the Secretary of State. And before they will issue a contractor's license, that individual contractor has to show proof of coverage through WSI. So that's one of the checks and balances we do have in place. The other check and balance we have in place is with Job Service North Dakota. We do a cross-referencing between policies maintained by Job Service North Dakota and maintained through WSI. And if there's any discrepancy, we do follow up with that contractor, not always a contractor, with that employer to verify their coverage needs at that time.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ammerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Jody. On the flip side of that, what are the employees, right? Say I'm an employee with one of these companies, they're non-compliant, you don't know who they are, they've never contacted you, I get hurt. Are they still covered where they can't sue? I mean, the company is not registered to you, they have never paid premiums, so are they still under that same obligation that they can't bring a lawsuit for the injury?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ammerman, that's a good question. We at WSI are not going to consider the status of that employee or that employer with respect to accepting the claim. If we think that employee was injured on the job, we will accept the claim. The benefits won't be affected. Now, can that employee still bring suit against an uninsured employer? Yes. There is a provision that is allowed, that does allow that exact scenario. You're right, they can sue. Okay, the next provision a couple of provisions actually work together, they have to do with how we charge premium. One basically has to do with volunteer disaster personnel. Recall a session or two ago, we added volunteer health practitioners. A provision in Title 37, I believe, regarding volunteer health care provisions or practitioners and how coverage is handled when we're sending our own health professionals to another state and vice versa. Well, what we forgot to do in our statute when that was amended was to actually put volunteer health practitioner into our provision in a place where it should be. And that's important because that provision talks about how we're going to determine premium for those individuals. So kind of an oversight there. The other areas that we're looking to modify to some extent are how we calculate premium for volunteers and how we calculate premium for those entities, schools that have internship programs for their students and send them out in the workforce. Historically, we've looked at a reasonable wage for those types of volunteer work and also for the internship programs. Sometimes they're finding it hard to have a reasonable wage or an equatable wage from which to calculate a premium. And so what they've been doing, and they, meaning Employer Services, the underwriters, have just been determining a reasonable fee for these types of positions. And we like a little bit of wiggle room in the law so we can either, one, if there's a reasonable wage from which we can determine a premium, we'll use that, or two, of a reasonable fee if one can't be determined. So that's what you'll likely see there. Lastly, a provision that again stems from our, I guess, the boom in the West primarily. If an organization is required to obtain coverage in North Dakota, an out-of-state entity, say from Oklahoma, what WSI requires right now, the law reads that they're obligated to report all wages paid in the state to WSI so we can assess premium. Well, what we've encountered is that, say for instance, an employer in Oklahoma cuts a check in Oklahoma to a wage earner in North Dakota. Well, they paid the injured worker in Oklahoma, so they're not reporting those wages. What we're proposing to change the statute to is to report all wages earned in that state. So close that loophole. Mr. Chairman, I think I've covered all the main highlights of our proposed legislation. Is there any questions before I sit down?
Any other questions for Jody?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
Senator Wardner?
Chairman, I do have one. Jody, I'm thinking about, you know, there are our private workers' comp or WSI company, you know, they buy, company can buy insurance from them for, and let's say they have it and they come into the state, could they, I know they're supposed to register here, but let's say they work and they file their claims with that other company, you'd never know it, right?
Mr. Chairman, as Senator Wardner, you're right. There are many claims that may be filed in other jurisdictions that we do not become aware of.
And so, along with that, I suppose if they come in here and they do register with you, and again, if you have a injury, that employee has the choice of either filing with North Dakota or that private company, whatever.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, Senator Wardner, you're exactly okay. Right.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Jody. Looks like IDL will have something to do in the next session again. All right. Last item on the agenda are committee directives to kind of close out our interim here, and I'm going to ask Jen to review those for us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. The only thing that I have left on my to-do list is we need a motion for preparation of the committee report and bill drafts, and that can be done with a voice vote. And then I also need a motion and voice vote to adjourn sine die, if you've reached that point.
Well, I think we have. I think we've completed the charges for the interim at this point in time. So if you would restate the first motion so somebody could make it.
Okay. The first motion is to move that the chairman and staff of the Legislative Council be requested to prepare a report in the bill drafts recommended by the committee and to present that report and recommended bill drafts to the legislative management.
Mr. Chairman, I so move.
Second.
And moved and seconded that motion as read be brought forward. And we can do that by voice vote. So all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. And if you would read the second motion.
Well, the second one's even easier. You'd carry by voice vote that the committee be adjourned, sine die.
Do I hear a motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move that this committee adjourn sine die.
Second. All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Head opposed? Motion passes. We are adjourned. Thank you all very much for your work. Enjoy the rest of your fall. And I hope you're ready for a fun time in January.